This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is away this week. Over the President's Day weekend, historians, former presidential advisors, first family members, archivists, and lovers of history got together for the first formal gathering to discuss the significance of presidential tapes recorded in the Oval Office. Political scholars looked to public documents, private letters, and interviews with aides and family members to bring a presidency to life. But like the proverbial fly on the White House wall, presidential tapes provide a unique glimpse into the inner workings of an administration. The existence of these tapes was big news when the Nixon tapes emerged in the 70s, but we now know that a number of presidents had taping systems in the Oval Office. The first one to try it out was Franklin Roosevelt. Here's FDR talking to several White House aides about a Japanese warning back in October 1940.
Late, Midway, and Pearl Harbor. First time that any damn Jap told us to get out of Hawaii.
President Franklin Roosevelt taped in the Oval Office in 1940. Since then, various presidential recordings from FDR to Clinton have become available. Have you ever heard any of these tapes? Did hearing them change your opinion of a president? Which president do you wish you could have heard taped? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. John Carlin is the archivist of the United States. He joins us now from his office in College Park, Maryland. Good to have you, Mr. Carlin.
Good afternoon, Lynn.
First, give us a sense of what came out of that conference that you attended last week on the White House tapes.
Well, I think a lot better understanding of the tapes and their value, their complexities, challenges certainly came out. We had six different administrations represented, and the quality of the taping, the technology used, the you know, in some cases, the Kennedy tapes were basically tapes of real critical, important meetings that were held, where it was a controlled situation in the sense that a decision was made to tape the meeting, although most participants were not advised. To telephone calls, for an example, with LBJ, where it was a selected on-off switch that the president controlled. But very high quality, and then the Nixon tapes where it was a voice-activated system. So we got it was a real good opportunity to bring people together and get people to better understand the huge values and yet the challenges and complexities that you have to take in consideration in really evaluating and using the tapes.
Well, overall, how do you assess the historical value of these tapes?
I think they're very significant. I think, obviously, they vary from one president to the next because of what was taped, how the tapes were used. But it's an additional dimension to other records. They complement what else we have in terms of other recordings, written documentation, still photos, videos, etc. And probably the most special aspect they contribute, well, I'd mention a couple of things. One, you get a in many cases, I would use Johnson as a particular example where you get a sense of the emotion that was going into the decisions and what was going on at the time. With Kennedy, because they chose, to, for example, the Cuban Missile Crisis, very significant historical development, we get a chance to listen in to the major players advising the president.
Apart from just the sort of that sort of fly on the wall element, that kind of listening in on history feeling, do the tapes really provide new information on these events?
I would say the Kennedy tapes for sure provide new information that is not provided anyplace else. Now, obviously, there are other documentation around these major events, but nothing quite like these tapes. So you'd have to very clearly say there's new significant historical information. I think with the Johnson tapes, for an example, as well as the others, you learn certain aspects that you wouldn't have gotten any other way, as well as a sense of the event that you can only get from actually listening. No transcription or somebody's personal notes later in personal papers donated to a library could possibly bring to the situation.
What are some of the most revealing discussions you've listened to?
Oh, again, I'd have to say the ones in the Kennedy in terms of those events, the Cuban Missile Crisis, certainly, the Johnson in terms of Vietnam War, in terms of, I mean, there's been a lot written and said and concluded about Johnson and the involvement of that administration, what they inherited, what they passed on. In listening to these tapes, you really get a sense that this was a day-by-day, over and over again throughout each individual day, a discussion with the key players trying to figure out what to do, and probably not only a better sense of the emotions of the president, but as well as the frustrations of all the players on trying to resolve something that just they desperately wanted to resolve but couldn't quite get a handle on a solution that would really work.
One interesting development, I understand there's a new technology that might help recover parts of tapes that have been erased, which of course has great significance with regard to Watergate. Tell us something about that.
Well, you're making reference to the 18-and-a-half-minute gap that is a product of the Nixon taping system, where there's been a great deal of interest for obviously many, many years as to what was erased. We do know conclusively something was erased. What we don't know is what exactly was on those 18 and a half minutes. Technology has improved and has improved to the point that the National Archives was willing to take some time and make an investment in evaluating those improvements in technology. And if over the next many weeks, months, I wouldn't want to set an exact time frame, if we would conclude that the technology is there, we would be willing then to risk trying that technology. But unless, Lynn, we're really confident, we're not going to take a chance, because very likely it's not something you can trot out a technology on this 18-and-a-half-minute original tape over and over without actually totally destroying any possibility in the future. So, like I say, if the technology proves to a satisfaction level that we're comfortable making the risk, we'll take it. Otherwise, we'll put it off till a little more time passes.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Carlin.
You're most welcome.
John Carlin is the archivist of the United States, and he joined us from his office in College Park, Maryland. Joining us now is William Doyle. He's the author of Inside the Oval Office, The White House Tapes from FDR to Clinton. He joins us from our New York bureau. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Doyle.
Hello, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Now, I think most people know about the Nixon tapes, but I would guess that a lot of people don't realize that Franklin Roosevelt actually started this this taping process. Why? Why did he do that?
He was concerned about being misquoted in the Oval Office in 1940, so he decided to put in a very experimental and primitive recording technology, really to have a backup for his own stenographer during important meetings, for example, with the leaders of Congress, and also press conferences. Now, why did he pick 1940 in the fall and late summer? That's because, I think it's because this was the only time in his presidency when he thought he might be thrown out of office, because the Republican candidate was very strong and was pulling up to him in the polls. So he was going into a very tough election. World War had already broken out in Asia and Europe, and he seemed to be very concerned about what he said and not saying the wrong thing. So he installed a microphone in his desk lamp and had RCA put in this experimental recorder. But the recorder captured some of the activity after the press conferences. So what you get is a very unguarded, almost accidental Oval Office atmosphere, which is like pure gold, because there's never been any record like this of the Roosevelt years.
Yeah. But then Truman, apparently, and Eisenhower, neither of them did any taping.
Well, in fact, Truman inherited Roosevelt's technology. In fact, he marched down in his first days in the White House to the chamber underneath the Oval Office to see what this contraption was all about. And according to a witness, he said something to the effect of, "I don't want anything to do with that damn thing. Let's shut it off." And he basically tested the machine a few times. There are tapes where nothing important happens, and that's it for Truman. But Eisenhower came in and haphazardly recorded some of the important meetings of his White House with a dictaphone machine, usually most of them in 1955. And he did that as in the Pentagon, and he was very open about it. He wrote about it in the book Crusade in Europe. And those tapes are today at the Eisenhower Library.
Now, I'm going to skip a minute to President Kennedy because we have a really fascinating clip of tape that I want to play. And as John Carlin, the Archivist of the United States, just mentioned, Kennedy taped a lot of very important events, historical events. And this clip is from September 30, 1962. It's of President Kennedy. He's pleading with the segregationist governor of Mississippi, Ross Barnett, to help stop a white riot. This is when James Meredith became the first black student at the State University. Let's listen to that tape and then talk about it a little.
We can't consider moving Meredith as long as there's a riot outside, because he wouldn't be safe.
Sir?
We couldn't consider moving Meredith if we haven't been able to restore order outside. That's the problem, Governor.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do, Mr. President.
Yeah.
I'll go up there myself.
Well, now, how long will it take you to get there?
And I'll get a microphone and tell them that you have agreed to be removed.
Now wait a minute. Wait a minute, Governor. Now, how long is it going to take you to get up there?
About an hour.
Now, I tell you what, if you want to go up there, then you call me from up there, and then we'll decide what we're going to do before you make any speeches about it.
Well, all right.
We got an hour to go, and that's not, we may not have an hour, but it won't take you an hour to get up there.
This man has just died.
Did he die?
Yes.
Which one, state police?
That's state police.
Yeah, well, you see, we got to get order up there, and that's what we thought we were going to have.
That's extraordinary. It certainly gives you an in-the-moment feel for the history of that time.
Right, and that's with bullets literally flying that neither man can stop in Oxford, Mississippi, with a state that is stumbling very closely into a kind of a micro-civil war. And neither man knows what's going to happen next, and both of their political futures are right on the line. And that's what, again, these tapes give you, is second by second, with the president not knowing what's going to happen next. Now, Kennedy knew he was taping that call, but that just adds to the drama, in my opinion, because now he's got other things to worry about on top of this armed rebellion that's breaking out in his own country.
All right, let's see if we can take one call, Jeff, before the break. Jeff in Seattle, Washington. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Go ahead.
You know, my question is, how valuable are these tapes when the speaker, i.e. the president, is aware of the taping? And, I mean, there's got to be some element of this that, you know, it isn't going to be candid. You know, I mean, you aren't going to just speak freely. So how valuable are these tapes?
I think that makes them even more electrifying. And Sheldon Stern, who was a former Kennedy Library historian, made this point beautifully at this conference last week. He said, don't assume that because the president knows that he's taping, that he knows how the crisis is going to come out, or that he knows how you and I feel 40 years later, whether or not he made the right decision. In other words, he was living through the moment in the moment. It was impossible to correctly position himself for historians and journalists 5 or 100 years from now. So, in my opinion, the opposite is true. It makes the whole process more dangerous and more intriguing, and it puts the president on guard.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, I was disappointed to hear that Truman didn't want anything to do with it after FDR, because it would be phenomenal to hear what happened, you know, towards the end of World War II and, you know, what went on in those offices.
Thanks for your call, Jeff.
Even on the Truman tapes, which are atmosphere only, it's random Oval Office atmosphere, and it's almost impossible to hear. You can hear Truman say at one point, we don't know who he's talking to, he just says, you know, I didn't want this job in the first place, but I've got it now, and I'm going to do the best I can. That's all I can do. And he says it so quietly and with such humility that it's like you're right next to him and you want to, you know, pat him on the shoulder almost.
We're talking about presidential taping in the Oval Office. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about presidential White House tapes. Our guest is William Doyle. He's the author of Inside the Oval Office, The White House Tapes from FDR to Clinton. Have you ever had a private conversation with a president? Join us in our discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. As we were saying before the break, President John F. Kennedy was a prodigious taper. What about LBJ? What happened when he came into office?
Well, Johnson was a phone nut. He did business. He lived and breathed and was president primarily on the telephone. So he hooked up his telephones to dictaphone machines, and he would signal his secretaries by twirling his finger in the air or saying, honey, take this down. And he would record most of the important phone business he did from 63 to 68. Late in his presidency, he installed a room recorder in the cabinet room and in the little study next to the Oval Office. But Johnson's tapes are completely priceless because you hear a president exerting power, presidential power, in real time, and there's nothing like Johnson for that.
And as I understand it, it was Johnson who suggested that President Nixon should record his conversations. Is that right?
Well, Johnson was writing his memoirs, and unfortunately, he didn't use much of the tapes, of the flavor of the tapes in his memoirs, because his memoirs are turgid and stale, and you know, they're almost unreadable. But he was consulting them. And he told Richard Nixon, you know, these are really helping me in writing my memoirs. You ought to put a system in. And Nixon, for 2 years, resisted that idea until in 1971, he decided apparently to protect himself against misquotation by his own people, for example, by Henry Kissinger, according to Haldeman, and possibly also to gather literary material for his own memoirs. He put in this voice-activated system that ultimately crucified him and, you know, hurled him back to California, and there are multiple ironies on that, one of which is that tapes that have come out in the last 5 years, if we had heard them in 1974, Nixon would have been ejected even faster from the Oval Office, but they've been released in kind of a haphazard, irregular pattern.
Well, it's interesting with hindsight, of course, that that Nixon and that perhaps none of these presidents really foresaw how these tapes could be used against them. I mean, it seems almost impossible for them not to have realized that they could have been used against them in some way.
Well, they seem to have all believed that it was their personal property, you know, despite the fact that the taxpayers paid for it and it's government business and so forth. But it never really occurred to any of them until 1973 and 4 that this might be taken from them. And that's, of course, Nixon paid the ultimate price for that. But the Nixon tapes are totally shocking, and they keep getting released, and he keeps disgracing himself, you know, over and over through the chambers of history. He can't escape what he actually said on these tapes. And the ultimate irony there is a lot of his own staff will tell you that he knew and we knew that we were not supposed to do what he told us half the time because he was letting off steam or having a temper tantrum. And, you know, that doesn't help him in history, but that might have been an actual reality.
And, of course, the Nixon tapes are famous for revealing the vulgarities that President Nixon sometimes used in private. We have a clip here of Richard Nixon giving orders to his incoming attorney general, orders to shut down an antitrust investigation into the ITT Corporation. Let's hear that tape.
Hi, Mr. President.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Good. How are you, sir?
Fine, fine. I'm going to talk to John tomorrow about my general attitude on antitrust. And in the meantime, I know that he has left with you the IT&T thing because apparently he says he had something to do with them once. Well, I have nothing to do with them, and I want something clearly understood. And if it is not understood, McLaren's ass is to be out within 1 hour. The IT&T thing, stay the hell out of it. Is that clear? That's an order.
You mean the order is to?
The order is to leave the goddamn thing alone. Now, I've said this, Dick, a number of times, and you fellows apparently don't get the message over there. I do not want McLaren to run around prosecuting people, raising hell about conglomerates, stirring things up at this point. Now, you keep him the hell out of that. Is that clear?
Well, Mr. President,
or either he resigns. I'd rather have him out anyway. I don't like the son of a bitch.
The question that is...
The question is, I know that the jurisdiction... I know all the legal things, Dick. You have to fill out the legal...
appeal file.
That's right.
A brief has to be filed tomorrow.
That's right. Don't file the brief.
Your order is not to file a brief.
My order is to drop the goddamn thing. Is that clear?
Yeah, I understand.
Okay.
That was President Richard Nixon giving orders to his incoming attorney general back in 1971. William Doyle, did he not realize how mean he sounded, or did he not care? How tough he sounds?
Well, think of what just happened. This was a felony, arguably, that you just heard a president commit on tape. He was obstructing justice in the IT&T scandal, which was really a dress rehearsal for Watergate. He's ordering his attorney general to shut down an investigation of IT&T, which was a contributor to the Republican Party, and he's doing it. And that eventually could have been an impeachable offense, but they never had the proof for it. And this is one of, you know, a boatload of shocking Richard Nixon tapes, and there's still more to be played. And if you never thought that Richard Nixon had a sense of humor, think about this. Richard Nixon, in the late 90s, tried to charge the American taxpayer $200 million for the theoretical value of the tapes that were seized from him in 1974, and he took that to court, and I testified for the government against that lawsuit. He was going to charge us for that kind of material because it was supposedly had a marketplace value. Now, that's history as comedy, I guess, but the Nixon tapes are priceless, and this is one reason that few presidents will ever tape after him, is because things like that can happen in the heat of the moment in the Oval Office.
Well, Alexander Butterfield knows a lot about the inner workings of the Nixon administration. He was a former deputy assistant to President Nixon from 1969 to 1973, and he joins us now from his home in La Jolla, California. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Butterfield.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Now, as I understand it, you were the one who had the Nixon's taping system installed. Is that right?
Yes, only because I was the liaison between the president and many activities, such as Mrs. Nixon's staff, the Secret Service, the FBI, and that sort of thing. So an order like that would properly come to me, and Haldeman just told me to have the taping system installed.
It was Haldeman who gave the order.
Oh, yes, it was Haldeman who gave the order, having just received it himself from the president.
How many people knew about that these tapings existed, these tapes existed?
Well, initially, and for the first couple of years until I testified, as far as I know, only seven, Nixon and Haldeman and myself, one of Haldeman's aides, and four Secret Service people, who were the four who put the machinery into place.
And you were the person who revealed the existence of the Watergate tapes.
Yeah, but not with any malice aforethought.
Did you? I was wondering if you had any idea what was going to come out of that.
Oh, sure I did. I mean, you would have to be... Yeah, no, I only revealed that deep, dark secret when asked a direct question by the Watergate committee. And yes, I knew probably better than most people what was going to happen. And what was going to happen to me, too, incidentally.
What did happen to you?
Well, I mean, I left government unceremoniously. No, I knew that Nixon would just die if this were revealed, but I felt I had no option there. Once I was asked the direct question, I did give some fuzzy answers at first because the questions I was getting were rather oblique, but once a direct question came, I naturally recognized it and said, I wished you hadn't asked that question. Yes, there were tapes in the Oval Office.
Why do you think Nixon wanted to install this tape system in the first place?
I feel I know that answer. I am as sure as I know I'm sitting here in La Jolla. There was no sinister purpose to it. He simply was a bug on history, as perhaps most presidents are. And we had a system in place prior to the installation of the tapes, which had to do with memos. We had someone write a memo about every single meeting the president had, and they were called memos for the president's file. And that was just for history. And I was the keeper of those memos, so people had to turn those memos into me within 24 hours of the time of the meeting. And once we had the tapes installed, which incidentally did not come until the administration was about 2 years old. Nixon became president in January of 69, and the tapes were installed in February of 71. And then when we did install the tapes and had them to go by, we retained system of the memos. So we had both things going in the interest of the history of his presidency.
Mr. Butterfield, if it were possible to restore those missing minutes, that
18 and a half minutes.
Yeah, those missing 18 and a half minutes. What would that reveal, do you think?
Well, at this tapes conference, I said rather brazenly that I felt I knew. I feel I know Nixon so well. I truly do. And Haldeman as well. I can almost tell you exactly what was on that 18 and a half minute silence. But, time the two had met in the Oval Office, because Nixon had been down in Florida for the weekend, as had Haldeman. And when they got back, this was their first real face-to-face meeting about this thing that had occurred, this break-in that had occurred. And I think, in essence, I won't go into all the details unless you want me to, Haldeman was just telling the president about the various vulnerabilities. I'm sure the president said, are we in trouble here, or can we keep this thing contained? Hopefully they wanted to contain it with the burglars and hope that one of them would confess that it was just a wild event that they had decided to undertake themselves. If someone found out that the committee to reelect the president was responsible for that break-in, then let's keep it contained there with the committee to reelect the president. Whatever we do, don't let it into the White House. And if it gets into the White House, for God's sakes, don't let it be associated with the Oval Office. So they were talking about the various vulnerabilities and how easy or how difficult that might be to do. And also, the FBI had just gotten into the case. I'm sure Haldeman told him on that silence that the FBI was now in on the investigation, because I think it's a federal law to tape people without their permission. So the FBI had just taken over that day from the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police. Hmm. So I can sketch out. In fact, I did for an article for Harper's Magazine some time ago, back in 94, state exactly what I thought was on that tape. But well, those were the two guys. They were the two real, honest-to-goodness, Watergate co-conspirators. And I think the silences that passed between them in the Oval Office and elsewhere spoke volumes.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Butterfield.
You're certainly welcome.
Alexander Butterfield is a former deputy assistant to President Nixon from 1969 to 1973. He joined us from his home in La Jolla, California. We're also talking with Alexander Butterfield. He's the former deputy. We're also talking with William Doyle. He's the author of Inside the Oval Office, The White House Tapes from FDR to Clinton. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We are, as I just said, talking about White House tapes. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's go to a caller, Dan in St. Paul. You are on Talk of the Nation. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Go ahead.
I'm just calling to say I found the tapes extremely valuable from an artistic standpoint. I did put together a theater show last year, and I spent a lot of time with the tapes, using them as a script and setting them up against Nixon's actual speeches. It was a one-man show. And I just, other than seeing the real depth of the crimes that he committed, I also got connected to him real in a personal way that really surprised me. And actually hearing a person like that struggling every day with the decisions, and particularly the tapes that didn't have to do with the crimes, I think just historically it was a fascinating time to sit inside Nixon's head for hour after hour like that.
That's an interesting use, William Doyle, quite an interesting use of those tapes.
Yeah, absolutely, and he's right, because it gets you right into Nixon's brain. And I think it was Gore Vidal wrote something like, Nixon appeared to have no conscious mind. It was all unconscious, free-flowing, id, and the darkest chambers of his mind were just all there on the tape. on his tapes. Something else happened at that conference last week that Mr. Butterfield spoke about. There was a man stood up and said, I'm a reporter retired from UPI, and I was down at the FDR ranch in the 60s, and I had a tape recorder, and I accidentally caught over-the-air transmissions between Lyndon Johnson and his ranch. In other words, a lost tape of Lyndon Johnson. And I am convinced that out there in the United States, in attics and forgotten desk drawers, there are tapes of presidents talking to, for example, congressmen. If you were a congressman in 1963, I don't know why you wouldn't have had a tape recording of President Kennedy if you spoke to him and if you had that technology, which many people did. And that congressperson's son or executors may have that material, and if they do, I think they should send it to John Carlin at the National Archives in Washington, because there may be some great material out there. Kennedy's secretary, for example, withheld about a dozen of Kennedy's tapes and just kept them in her house for 30-plus years and turned them over just in the 1990s. So the concept of lost tapes is very interesting, and I think that people ought to try to turn them in if they have them. I think the statute of limitations has run out on on taping phone calls probably.
Well, if anybody out there has some lost tapes, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255, or you can email us at totn@npr.org. Let me ask you, Mr. Doyle, of all the tapes that you've listened to, is there one, is there one that really is more revealing than any other that you just can't believe when you listen to it, or can you pinpoint one?
Well, yeah, Cuban Missile Crisis. Mr. Carlin spoke about that, and this is so hard to get when you read a history or when you read a memo. You have to hear Curtis LeMay, the Air Force general, face to face with President Kennedy in a meeting with the door closed, says to him across the table, "This," meaning your blockade plan of Cuba, "this is just as bad as the appeasement at Munich." Now, that's a military man telling the president that you're Neville Chamberlain and you're a coward. And you're making the wrong decision. So that, to me, among many other examples, is again, it's reality history as opposed to, written history from people who weren't there.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the presidential White House tapes. Our guest is William Doyle. He's the author of Inside the Oval Office: The White House Tapes from FDR to Clinton. We'll continue our discussion in a moment. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the taped Oval Office conversations of the presidents. Our guest is William Doyle. He's the author of Inside the Oval Office: The White House Tapes from FDR to Clinton. And I want to go quickly to another clip of tape of one of the president's conversations. This would be President Ford, President Gerald Ford. And this clip, on September 1st, 1975, President Ford called his Secretary of State Henry Kissinger to congratulate him on reaching a ceasefire agreement with the Israelis and Egyptians. Let's hear that clip of tape.
You don't have any objections, I trust.
No, I don't have any objections.
Well, I think they wanted it for historical purposes.
All right, that was Gerald Ford talking to his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. That was a brief piece of tape. But what that tape told us is that what Gerald Ford was doing was signaling to Henry Kissinger, telling him right out that he was being taped. And this was a pretty significant change that occurred in the Ford administration, was it not, William Doyle?
Well, Ford taped nothing except for three phone calls in 1975 that we know about, including that one. And he had the decency to tell Henry Kissinger, "Hey, I'm taping you. Do you mind?" Which I have never heard on any of the hundreds and hundreds of tapes I've heard, which is a testament really to the kind of humility and decency that Gerald Ford is rightly known for. But Ford ordered all of the tapes to be pulled out of his Oval Office. And that was one of his reasons for being president. He swore to the American people that there'd be nothing like that happening. And that really was the death of presidential taping, with a couple of minor exceptions. Reagan had a White House television crew follow him around, as did George Bush and Bill Clinton, and they sometimes captured kind of in-between moments where actual meetings would be starting and the video cameras would still openly be in the room before they left the room. And there's some interesting Reagan material out there. And Clinton had these White House cameras too, and they nearly got him in trouble in 1996 when he was caught on tape telling donors how he was basically exploiting campaign finance laws.
Well, we have a clip of President Clinton from a May 21st, 1996 videotape. President Bill Clinton is talking to Democratic donors in this tape. Let's hear that.
The fact that we've been able to finance this long-running, constant television campaign where we were always able to frame the issues, most of it's been actually quite positive, you know, not sort of big negative hit on the Republicans, but just trying to show the differences in what we're trying to achieve, has been central to the position that I now enjoy in the polls.
You know what strikes me about that, Mr. Doyle, is how different that is from the earlier tapes that we heard, where it seemed that even though the presidents knew that the tape machine was going, they were conscious of that, they must have somehow forgotten about it. And of course, this is just sounds very staged by comparison.
Well, that's a closed presidential meeting with donors, so it's an actual working meeting. But what's interesting is that he just fouled up there, because he was technically violating the campaign finance laws. You'll notice that he explained how essentially soft money was being used to directly benefit his reelection campaign, which is wrong, and that violates at least the spirit of that law. Now, the Republicans said that that tape, among others, was a smoking gun on that issue, and in the end, nothing happened, of course, because Republicans were doing very similar things, and Reagan, there are tapes of Reagan in the White House talking to donors, which you're not supposed to do on White House grounds or during a presidential, you know, office hours. So that was kind of a Mexican standoff, to use a ill-chosen phrase, and it didn't go anywhere. But it does show that even Clinton could get tripped up in the, you know, the daily tangle of presidential legality.
We're talking about White House tapes. The number here is 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Peter in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I appreciate your time. My concern is, as much as I appreciate the public's curiosity and historical value, and even perchance our president's desire to tape his work, I'm a little concerned about, especially in our day and age, that when we're dealing with, you know, the terrorists and things like this, that some of this material might be leaked, and I'm a little concerned about his privacy. He's being taped, you know, he's on stage in a way, you know. I don't know. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Okay, Peter, let's have Mr. Doyle respond.
Okay.
Well, you put your finger on the ultimate paradox of this whole discussion, which is that we've got to give the president room to think and room to plan and room to lose his temper and for us not to see it as it happens. And in fact, Congress thought up a really good scheme in 1978 when they laid down the law on this issue. They said, let's give them 12 years until after they leave the presidency, and then let's release all this material. And then in the meantime, let's give the National Archives custody. They've done a beautiful job with it. Nothing ever leaks out of the National Archives. They're very good at their business. But interestingly, this current president has decided to overturn that law of 1978 with an executive order saying that the president, the current president, the former president, and the former president's family have the ability to veto any of these releases, which really is turning that 1978 law upside down. And also, Attorney General Ashcroft ordered all government agencies essentially to slow down or resist the release of items through the Freedom of Information Act. And that's fine for national security and terrorism. I agree with that totally. But for everything else, it makes for very bad history. And I don't think that will last. I think that, in fact, there's a Republican in Congress who's introduced a bill to negate or nullify that executive order. And I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. So where do you think that we will be getting more tapes in the future then, or is this the end of presidential tapes?
It ended in 1974, and that's a bad thing because, in my opinion, the president ought to, on a quiet news day, go out at 3 o'clock with his press secretary and say, by the way, from now on, we might tape all the important business of the White House because it's everybody's business, and we've got to get a perfect or as good a record as we can of what goes on here, just as being, you know, good executives. And that should happen. It's unfortunate that it won't. But let's not forget, as Ronald Reagan said, the government exists to serve the people, not the other way around. And that's why all this material ultimately belongs to you and I.
What president would you like to have heard taped before the era of taping? What piece of history would you really have liked to have heard that, of course, couldn't have gotten taped?
Harry Truman had to have been the most humble, ordinary, and warmest, I think, of the Americans who served in that office. And I think that those tapes would probably be the most precious. But, you know, to think about Pearl Harbor, the day of Pearl Harbor, to get 24 hours of that would be priceless, too. And everything that goes on in that office is electrifying, again, because that's our office and our lives are at stake. So I think that, you know, it's all really wonderful history. And the fragments that we have really give us a much deeper picture of the human beings inside that office, because that's perhaps the ultimate horror is that these are human beings. They're not oil portraits on a wall.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
William Doyle is the author of Inside the Oval Office, The White House Tapes from FDR to Clinton. He joined us from our New York bureau. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.